your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, July 20th, 2025. As we record this new show, what a weekend in Pittsburgh. If you can't tell by the sound of my voice, I had a lot of fun this past weekend with everybody that traveled to Pittsburgh. We at Sox Machine, along with our friends from the 108 and the Chicago Sports Bums, we had our annual road trip visiting the Steel City. Lots of hashtag 108ing took place. So we were going to have fun no matter what. But boy, did the White Sox bats do a number to the Pirates pitchers this weekend and seriously put a dent in my chances of winning a steak dinner. 27 runs scored in three games powered the White Sox to a three-game sweep, the first one of the 2025 season over the Pirates. We'll recap that series and what happened in Pittsburgh. Check in on the trade stock values for Adrian Hauser, Mike Tauchman, and Luis Robert Jr. because we are getting closer to the trade deadline on July 31st. The White Sox visit the Tampa Bay Rays and will be playing in another minor league park. And as we always do on Mondays, we take a look around Major League Baseball, and it's getting hard to ignore what Andrew Vaughn has been doing with the Milwaukee Brewers. He's hitting at a level we have rarely saw during his time with the White Sox, and the Milwaukee Brewers look unbeatable recently. Joining me is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis, as our beat reporter James Fegan is still traveling home from Pittsburgh. And hello, Jim. It was great to hang out with you in Pittsburgh this weekend.
Likewise, and it was good to hang out with 150 of our closest friends, I think the final headcount was, showing up at McFadden's. Great weekend of baseball, a lot of fun. Weather was pretty good, a little steamy, a little humid for Pittsburgh, but I think overall, relative to Nashville especially, like, I will take high 80s and a little bit humid versus getting rained out all weekend or anything else you can encounter in late July. So yeah, I'll take it.
What was the highlight of the weekend for you, Jim?
I was happy to be in Pittsburgh. I'd only been in Pittsburgh once before, and it was back in 2006, after the World Series win. And I remember thinking, like, oh, it's, hadn't been to Pittsburgh, looking forward to it. The ballpark looks great. I've heard good things, and it was incredible. And then 19 years went by and I didn't go back to Pittsburgh until now. And it's a great city. And I think that was a common theme among, talking to everybody who came, was like, whether people had been to Pittsburgh or not, is, this is nice. Hotel is right across from the ballpark. Walkable, lots to do in terms of the river, museums, the strip district with Little Italy. That's awesome. Plenty of good breweries, plenty of good places to go. So, Pittsburgh, very underrated. People are friendly. Everybody is happy to, you go in the strip district, especially, like, all the stores selling Pittsburgh stuff. The amount of Yinzer pride, the way that's peddled, I think is something you don't see, or like, it definitely punches above its weight when it comes to civic pride. So it's nice to go there and see, like, the pride, the hospitality, like, mix of, we have a great city, we're happy you get to enjoy this great city, which I think, is a tricky balance to pull off, and they do it.
Yeah, now Pittsburgh's got a lot of heart. Even though they're the Steel City, they show a lot of heart, and it's a great city to visit over the weekend. So if you're a Bears fan, even if you're a Blackhawks fan, and you're looking at the NFL or NHL schedules, since you got a chance to, you didn't make it to Pittsburgh to see the White Sox and Pirates, definitely find a reason for you to go visit Pittsburgh. I like it a lot, and I'm glad so many people got to enjoy it. So for our road trip recap, Friday night, we started with our impromptu meetup at Mike's Beer Bar. And that's a great little spot right across the street from PNC Park. And after that meetup, because there was Yinzerpalooza going on the street. So the Pirates had a bunch of tents and they brought in food trucks right outside the stadium. So a lot of activity going on. I did try some of the new food. I did try the cannonballs, that deep fried ball with the egg noodles, the Polish sausage, the cabbage, and a lot of cream cheese. There's a lot of cream cheese for me. I did not like the cannonball, Jim. Did you get a chance to try it?
I didn't. Didn't sound. I only heard about it secondhand, but from what I heard, it didn't make me want to go find it.
Yeah. And then the Polish sausage cheesesteak. I thought it would be a Polish sausage on top of a net regular cheesesteak. No, instead of the steak, you just replace it with a bunch of cut up Polish sausage, which is fine. I love Polish sausage, so that was all right. But I did try a couple of the Pittsburgh food items. They were okay. Saturday night, McFadden's, our pregame party, and it was so awesome to see, as Jim mentioned, 150 people show up. And I'm very grateful for the McFadden staff, especially the bartenders, because everybody was ready to go immediately. So those poor bartenders, wave after wave of people, but they did a fantastic job serving us. But I was not expecting to see the lines that we saw outside the stadium, Jim, for the Mac Miller bobblehead.
Yeah, that was a revelation.
I'd never seen anything like that in Chicago. You had to have 25,000 people waiting in line. Like, did you tell me that the line, because I had to get to McFadden's early to set up, the line crossed the Roberto Clemente Bridge?
Yes, with like hours to spare.
Wow. I mean, I did my exercise walk at 9 in the morning past PNC Park, and there was like five people at the gate outside of the Roberto Clemente statue. And I thought that was just kind of humorous. Like, you're gonna be there all day, and I hope they got a bobblehead. But yeah, just that was eye-opening. So you have all these White Sox fans trying to go to the meetup, and that's what everybody was talking about at the bar. I was like, I can't believe how many people are just standing outside trying to get this Mac Miller bobblehead. But both games being there and watching the White Sox offense just crush really drove the excitement as well, being together as a group. We finally had a road trip, Jim, in which the White Sox won the Saturday game. They had won
Yes.
Friday games previously, but they never won on Saturday. And it finally happened. And to do it in comeback fashion was just made it even more exciting. Thank you, John Schriffen and CHSN. John stopped by to the pregame party. That was awesome for him. He got a tattoo. So we do the temporary tattoos at the meetup, and he got
Kind of
one.
against his will, but eventually he succumbed,
Yeah,
got strong-armed into it.
you can't say no to Maddie, our tattoo artist. There is no saying no to Maddie. You will be getting a tattoo whether you like it or not. But it was great that John gave us a shout out on both broadcasts on Friday and Saturday, and he took a couple koozies as well. Gave one to Dan Plesac. I'm sure Dan will use that in the future. But for this road trip, again, a huge thank you to our friends from the 108, Cherezi, Beefloaf, and My Sock Summer, our friends over at the Chicago Sports Bums. It was Dougie's birthday. Happy birthday, Dougie. But Jason and Joey and Peter Baloney, thank you guys so much for coming out to Pittsburgh. Our wives, thank you so much for your help, especially my wife, Kim, and our best friend, Brittany, in helping organizing and checking people in. It takes a village to pull this type of event off. So again, thank you to everyone. And Marriott was great to us. The Renaissance and Spring Hill Suites getting a block of rooms. Madeline, the manager at McFadden's, thank you guys so much. And the Pittsburgh Pirates for getting us a great group rate for Saturday and getting us all 150 of us to sit in the same section. It was fantastic. Now, if you're hearing this and you're like, man, Josh, I already had FOMO. I saw all your guys' photos and videos on social media.
So
I
all
already
Yin's
have FOMO.
photos.
I already have FOMO. I wish I was there. What's the plan for next year? This is a plan for the 2026 meetup. We're going to have two. That's the plan right now. We need the 2026 schedule. The first will be the Milwaukee tailgate. So the White Sox will be visiting the Milwaukee Brewers next year. They have been weekend series. If it is a weekend series again, we plan to host a tailgate along with our friends from the 108 to the Chicago Sports Bums. The Bums crushed it last year when we had all that rain and we had all those tents, and they brought in the backup tents when we really needed them to try to keep people dry. It did make it more eventful, but I do not hope we get rain the next time we have it. But if the White Sox play Milwaukee over the weekend, we will be having another tailgate. The travel destination. This is our short list. St. Louis, Toronto, Detroit. The blackout weekend is 4th of July. We will not have our annual road trip over 4th of July. So when that 2026 schedule comes out, I know everybody checks for your own personal reasons, weekends, stadiums you haven't been to that you could cross off your list. But for next year's annual trip, that's the short list that we're looking at. Looking at what weekend possibly Milwaukee is and who gets a weekend, St. Louis, Toronto, and Detroit. Any of those excite you, Jim?
Well, I think Easter is other weekend we don't do. That's another one that's,
yes.
Yeah.
Good point.
Just amount of people who wouldn't be able to travel wouldn't be as fun. So those are the two weekends, generally speaking, that are off. But yeah, terms of, I think, pound for pound, St. Louis is probably the best in terms of newish stadium that a lot of people haven't been to yet. 4 hours away from Chicago, multiple ways to get there. Similar setup to what you had in Cincinnati, though that's the one I missed because of COVID. But then, you know, Pittsburgh was kind of similar. Minnesota was kind of similar in the sense of having, you know, bars around, multiple event spaces to either rent out, or in this case, you know, with St. Louis, depending on how it is, when you actually start talking, like, is the case where you can just meet up in the middle because they've closed it all off, and you know, there it's you don't have to worry about taking a beverage out of one place and being in trouble because you're on the street with it. So I think like that's probably, I think, the best in terms of convenience, excitement, and yeah, convenience, I think, for us, convenience for everybody. It's the way to go. And I think the simpler it is for us to plan, the more fun, you know, especially you, like, because you do the bulk of the work. I would say everybody said, like, great job putting it together. And I said, it was mostly Josh. No stolen valor here. He is the one, before we even like think to say yes, you've already planned out like 80% of it. That's just how you work. When it comes to, you know, the simplifying your list, like I would put St. Louis first, Detroit second, Toronto third. I think Toronto, just when you have, well, one, when you have passports involved, that's one thing. The other thing is that I've been to Toronto and it feels like, feels too Chicago-y, like in a way, like I wouldn't mind going back there because I would like to, you know, explore the neighborhoods more and get a better sense of it. But first time there, I was like, it kind of feels like Chicago, like in, you know, that's why it's takes Chicago's place in movies so often because of that. But in terms of giving a different feel to it, like the cities we've gone to, especially the last 2 years, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, being able to, you know, get a feel for both cities and get like the full experience. I think like St. Louis would be a nice, continuation of that.
Well, let us know in the comments section and on social media which cities you're rooting for. If you work for a hotel group or a convention center or a chamber of commerce and you have a schedule leaked to you, help a brother out. Okay. It helps me with planning. The more time I get, the more grander we can make this. So let's all hope we get that 2026 schedule sooner than later. We already had 2025s last year at this point. So I'm wondering what the delay is.
I mean, I prefer the later leak. It felt weird when like it's less than the halfway point and like you're already thinking about next year. It felt like a concession to just like this year sucks. Start thinking about it. And so I prefer it to be like an August or September thing versus July or earlier, just because I think it's just too soon to start waving away the rest of the schedule.
Got it. Well, we got the NHL schedule last week, so we're waiting on Major League Baseball and see how that plays out. And as soon as we know, we will make a grand announcement in what the plans are for meetups in 2026. So if you missed out on Pittsburgh and you're telling yourself there's no way I am missing out in 2026, now you know what the short list is. Now you know what you're looking for in the schedules when it does get announced. So let's talk some White Sox baseball. Offensively, as we mentioned in the intro, what a monster weekend. The White Sox won on Friday 10-1. Saturday, they won 10-4. That was a comeback because the White Sox were down 4-2 at one point. Sunday, they won 7-2 with a monster first inning. Back-to-back home runs from Miguel Vargas and Mike Tauchman. Tauchman is the first White Sox hitter to hit a home run in Pittsburgh into the river since Jim Thome did it back in 2006. So that's pretty awesome. Will Venable had this to say about the weekend series sweep with reporters after Sunday's win.
Yeah, it's great. You know, and regardless of the results, it's the way that we've been playing, playing hard, coming out with energy. That's the most important thing. And guys look rested and, you know, excited to be out there. And that's what we want, just going out there and competing.
Now, R.J. Siegen, like we mentioned, is still traveling back home from Pittsburgh, but he asked both Venable and Mike Tauchman about the team's renewed approach to be more aggressive against fastballs.
Talking about being aggressive on the fastball, Heaney is a fastball-heavy guy. How much do you see that kind of pay off in the first inning?
A lot, you know, and it's not necessarily just hitting the fastball. But when you get ready for the fastball, you put yourself in a really good spot to hit other pitches. I thought we saw that from a number of guys there in that first inning. And really good job, obviously, Vargas putting a nice swing on it and then followed by Talk, just guys ready to hit.
Phil's been talking about the offense is doing a good job zone control all season. The next step was kind of turn around more fastballs. Do you see that kind of put into action these three games here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard in this game if you're not competitive with fastballs, especially in the heart of the plate. Guys are hard, so you got to be ready to go. I think we have a lot of guys that control the zone, and I think the next step in that is control the zone, but being aggressive to your pitch. So we've done a good job of controlling the zone, but the next step is, all right, boys, like, you know, when you earn those 2-0-3-1 counts and you're in those big heater counts, like, commit to it and let it rip, you know, and kind of whatever happens after that is what happens.
Now, Jim, the White Sox did have a Friday team meeting prior to the series to talk about this point, being more aggressive against fastballs. Is it that easy to point to for this weekend's offensive success as a message heeded by Sox hitters and they capitalized against fastballs? Or is the Pirates pitching that bad?
I would say the Pirates pitching factored into it. Bailey Falter doesn't really strike anybody out. Andrew Heaney came out throwing like 87, 88, both from the left side. I think you're seeing right now with Luis Robert Jr., the form he's in, like, he hits lefties a lot better than righties. So to bring in a couple lefties who don't miss bats and feed into the strengths of the White Sox more, I guess, mercurial hitters. Like, when Robert's on, the lineup looks a lot different. When Chase Mydroth is doing something, lineup looks a lot different. Miguel Vargas, another one where when he's hitting, the lineup has a middle. So I think that helped. But we've seen stretches where the White Sox don't hit anybody very well, or they overthink it. They get into bad counts, and just by the time the fifth inning's over, they're trailing, and then the bullpen can come in and just work one inning at a time. So they did what they had to do against the opponents that they had presented to them. I don't think it'll be this easy going forward, but I think, you know, when it came to just the White Sox and how poorly they performed against fastballs, pretty simple game plan for opponents. So anything that makes them have to think more, you know, they can always flip the script and, you know, throw more breaking balls, et cetera. But, you know, if they get into worse counts because they're throwing pitches that are hard to locate for strikes, then perhaps it just makes a more challenging day overall. And you don't get the stretch where they're, you know, the league's worst offense and they're going to easily coast to a steak dinner victory for you. Bad news for you that they can hit the fastball a little bit when, you know, the fastballs are unimpressive. But good news, I think, just for watchable baseball.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the big offensive performances this weekend with Luis Robert and Mike Talkman in our next segment when we take a look at the trade stock value for some key White Sox players that are available to be dealt before the trade deadline. But Lenin Sosa went 4-for-12. Miguel Vargas really needed this weekend, Jim. He goes 4-for-13, but it's power. It's three doubles and a home run. And it's good to see that level of power because, like, to your point that you just made, when Vargas is an extra base threat, and as long as you still have Talkman in the lineup ahead of Vargas, this is where the White Sox can generate some instant offense.
Yeah, and, you know, Talkman against the lefty, like, that's nice to see. You know, not getting in the situation where Venable has to make every single change to maintain the handedness advantage throughout the game and get, you know, substitute himself into some dark corners later in the game after he's made all his moves. You know, Talkman could be gone very quickly to where, you know, where we can appreciate the competence while it lasts, but every time he hits a lefty, it's like one less move that Venable has to make. And, you know, he can worry about the finer points of, like, the infield rotation that he has going on, or the catcher, you know, back and forth that he has between Teal and Caro, or the left field balance he has versus needing both corner spots and second base and third base and catcher and whoever's DHing to be not trustworthy against same-sided pitching. So, yeah, I guess, you know, Talkman, the more he does this, the less likely it is that he spends much more time with the White Sox, but you take it where you can get it.
The White Sox as a team had 14 doubles in three games against the Pirates, Jim. Like, I know the team needs to hit more home runs, but the team just needs more power in general. 14 doubles in three games. I mean, I find that to be a really good sign. And I just felt like with PNC Park, I know it's a big outfield out there. And there were some very close plays, especially O'Neill Cruz at center field, almost got to Mike Talkman's bases clearing double that really changed the entire game for the White Sox to win on Saturday. But until we see more home runs, and hopefully that does come, if the fallback is with being aggressive with more fastballs, we're going to see more doubles from the White Sox. I'll take that. Like, any sign of power, any sign of offense where it's more than just singles and walks and try to compile two singles and a walk and hoping that you get one run out of that inning, I'll take more doubles from the White Sox offense.
Yeah, and PNC Park going into Sunday, 70 homers in 98 games. Yeah, right now it's only like Globe Life, Kauffman, Oracle. Like, it's playing more hitter, or at least homer unfriendly, than all those parks classically considered to be. Well, I guess not in Texas's case because it's so new and evolving, but, like, yeah. San Francisco, we hear all the time that you can't hit a homer there, or, like, nobody hits 30 homers there since Barry Bonds. And, you know, Pittsburgh is playing, like, a standard deviation stingier when it comes to homers. So you want to see doubles there, because that means those doubles there are homers elsewhere, especially when you have the White Sox, the White Sox bullpen down the left field line. Like, that's a harder home run to come by at PNC. And yeah, to have those, the ability to get over the, you know, Chase Mydroth almost hit one out. Kyle Teal almost hit one out, very top of the wall. You know, Mydroth had the one interfered with, but that was, you know, clearly a fan interference on the other side of the fence. Teal missed his by, like, inches on the top of the right field wall. So the approaches were there. The contact, like, the type was there. They just needed a different setting. But I'm glad Teal, I know he's trying to get off the schneid in the home run column, but that would be a terrible way for him to hit a homer, stopping at second base while everybody figures it out. He should be able to actually savor it more. That one is not the way to do it.
I feel it's coming, though. With Teal, I feel like his first home run's coming, because Caro picked up another home run in this series as well on Friday.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm not surprised Caro, because I think we had this conversation before. Like, I'm not surprised Caro beat Teal to one, just because, you know, he's had more chances to do so. But I am surprised that Caro has two now and Teal doesn't have any. Like, I didn't think he'd be a, you know, be able to win by two in this race, and right now he is.
Well, let's take a look at the trade stock for the White Sox key assets after a monster weekend against the Pittsburgh Pirates. We're going to start with starting pitcher Adrian Hauser, because we both agreed when we took a look at the White Sox trade value as far as players available before the deadline, Adrian Hauser is number one. And on Saturday, it's hard for me to grade exactly what we saw from Hauser. 4 1/3 innings. It's the shortest outing with the White Sox. He allowed 10 hits, but only 3 earned runs. He walked only 1. And he struck out 5 against the Pirates on Saturday. In 10 starts this season, Hauser still has a sub-2 ERA. He's at 1.89 over 62 innings with 44 strikeouts and 19 walks. Jim, after his last start against the Pittsburgh Pirates, Adrian Hauser's trade stock, did it go up? Did it stay still? Or did it go down?
I would say reflexively, when you look at the performance, you say it went down, but he did, you know, I guess this did resemble regression. He was obviously pitching, you know, well over his head. You know, he's not going to be somebody with an ERA who starts with one. You know, the BABIP is back to normal now, more or less, with the barrage of hits that he absorbed. He seemed like his arm was fine. He was throwing 95 routinely with the sinker. Every time I saw a hit, I looked at the scoreboard because we had the angle from the side, so I couldn't really exactly see the sequences that well. But every time I looked at the scoreboard after he gave a hit, it was sinker. Like, it seemed like he was not being beat on his secondary pitches, which I think both meant that they were okay when he located them, but also didn't execute them well enough to where he probably had to go to sinkers or, you know, be in fastball counts more. And, you know, when he doesn't miss bats, you know, that turns into hits. You know, none of them went over the fence. They were all grounders and low line drives. So I would think that teams who already modeled him to be, you know, not as good as he's been statistically, but look at the arm, look at the way it's playing, the kind of contact it generated. I would probably say that those teams might not be seeing anything different from one start to another. Just a matter of, you know, being able to sell it. I think that's if the White Sox traded Hauser, you know, when he had a 1 ERA for a prospect who's not in the top 100, look like a heist, you know, from the outside, whereas teams might be like, nice, he's not worth that right now. We really need to be desperate for the market to shift in a way where, you know, Hauser costs 1 or 2 top prospects. So that's why I'm skeptical. It meant a whole lot. If he came out like throwing 93, if he came out giving up homers and just, you know, just having no bite on anything, I could see it being like, they didn't sell quick enough, but I think this just looked like regression more than anything.
Yeah, I'm no change for Hauser for his trade value. Now, his next start projected to be against the Chicago Cubs at home. I think that start, if he doesn't get traded before then, Jim, is going to have a lot to say in what the White Sox get back in return. If Hauser can bounce back and he goes 6 strong innings against that lineup of the Chicago Cubs, that may sway some teams that are on the fence to pull the trigger and make the move to get Adrian Hauser. Because then he proved that he can be solid or even better than that against one of the best offenses in Major League Baseball. So I think this next start is huge for Adrian Hauser and the Chicago White Sox to determine, one, if he does get dealt, and I do think he will get dealt before the deadline, but two, what kind of return Chris Getz can get for Adrian Hauser, Jim. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, in a way, like, I think he's shown plenty against good offenses. Like, he held the Blue Jays in check, you know, most recently whenever they were hot and everybody's thinking like, oh, this could be what kills his trade value, and it doesn't. So, like, I don't think at this point he's somebody who, yeah, like, going back to the models, I think he's somebody who he's pretty known. It's more a matter of, I guess, this newfound velocity. Does the curveball and changeup play up more than it did? And can you see that lasting the rest of the season? If he has like one bad start against the Cubs, but he's throwing again like 95 and like the secondary stuff just isn't located, I don't know if it'll change much. But yeah, if he comes out, throws a quality start against the Cubs and is getting either the swings and misses or just the useless contact against the curve and changeup, then I think you can say, yeah, he's back. He's not turning into a pumpkin. He's just, he's subject to have a bad start or a contact laden, 10 hit, lots of base runners, lots of traffic all game start once in a while.
Let's move over to Mike Tauchman. So Tauchman against the Pirates this weekend, he played in two of the three games. Tauchman went 3-for-7 against the Pirates, two doubles, a home run. He had six RBIs against the Pirates this weekend. In 47 games, Tauchman now has a .289 batting average for the season, .383 on base percentage. He's slugging .464. He has five home runs and 25 RBIs with 12 doubles. He already matched last year's double total this season with the two doubles over the weekend. So he has as many doubles in 47 games as he did last year in over 100 games in 2024. Jim, after the big weekend against the Pirates, did Mike Tauchman's trade value go up, stay still, or go down?
I would say up, less because of the performance itself and more for showing that he's healthy, showing that he can run. I think with Tauchman, he's not so special that teams want to rush to trade for him and seal themselves off from making, I guess, more exciting acquisition. Yeah. But the fact that he was running not great, that the fact that his sprint speed was 0.1 mph higher than Edgar Caro's is not what you want out of a corner outfielder. And I think it just showed that he was guarding his leg, that he's not running 100% if he can absolutely avoid it. But like, he looked fine in the right field. He made that nice outfield assist, helped Hauser end an inning by getting down to the right field line, making good on target throw. So watching him in right field when he has to run, I think he's doing it well enough. I think it just went on the base paths. If he's not going to beat out a grounder, or if he thinks he's going to shut it down at third base rather than scoring at home, like, he's going to take them up on it and not risk ruining the hamstring again. But every series where he's providing quality at bats and running when he needs to and playing both sides of the ball, I think convinces a team that, you know, if they're either their acquisition list, if they get beat to somebody that they wanted, or if they just feel like they need more of a depth guy than somebody who's a frontline starter, they're going to wait to make sure that Tauchman stays healthy at the White Sox until they have to trade for him. So the fact that he does, like, every series, I think only helps. And, you know, I've likened him to, you know, not terribly exciting outfielders that get moved, like David Peralta. Another one I thought of this past week was Mark Canha, of just the guy who, we need another quality bat. We need a bench bat. We need a platoon guy. We need somebody who can lengthen the lineup. And I think Tauchman fits that as long as he's running.
Yeah, and you hear teams all the time, they like to add that type of veteran presence in the clubhouse. It makes the transition a lot easier because it's a veteran. One more shot of trying to get postseason glory. Mike Tauchman's not a spring chicken. He's 35. See how much longer the legs hold up for
him.
Still
has a year of team control, though, after this year.
Still does, but he's hitting really well this season. He's having a great offensive season when he's been able to be on the field. I agree with you, Jim. I do think that the trade stock did go up after this weekend. It's just another solid weekend to convince teams that he will be worth the risk of acquiring him before the deadline. Final, Luis Robert Jr. So Robert against Pittsburgh. 5-for-10, a home run, 3 RBIs. He walked 3 times. He only struck out once, and he also picked up 3 stolen bases. Robert, in his last 15 games, is batting .255 with a .364 on base percentage and slugging .532. That's more like it. That's an .896 OPS. That's what we were hoping for before the All-Star break for the season. He's got 4 home runs and 10 RBIs in his last 15 games. Robert, with this recent hot stretch, is now finally above the Mendoza line. He's batting .201 for the season with 10 homers, 38 RBIs. He set a new single season high. He now has 34 walks this year. That's the most walks he's ever had in a season. And he's 25-for-31 in stolen bases. After the big weekend against the Pirates, Jim, did Robert's trade stock go up, stay still, or go down?
Well, he also had that catch in center field, too.
He did. Yeah.
The tracking a long way two left center, full extension, perfectly timed to break hearts at PNC Park. So when he's running like that, when he's changing games in the base paths, also set a career high in stolen bases. So he's at, he set a career high with 24. So there are parts of his game that are fully formed or back where they need to be with the legs, which I think if you said last year that Robert is going to be setting a career high in walks while playing good defense and running the base with the bat, you think like, great, what are you going to get for him? And then it turns out the bat isn't there. I think, you know, a lot of his production is better production coming against lefties. I think teams acquiring him have a good idea of what he could do. So I think in one sense, his trade value did go up because a team acquiring him says, great, he can play center field. He can be a force in the base paths and he can hit lefties. Against righties, that trade stock might not be there still because they just might need more production against the right-handed pitching in order for the big acquisition with the amount of money he's going to cost. The White Sox don't throw in that much money to cover salary. It's a non-negligible amount when it comes to either the talent given up or the money spent. So that's, I think, the one area where he didn't raise his trade value. But I think over the past couple series, you know, the month that you said the production, it's skewed towards hitting lefties. And at least that's something that teams can plan around. This more enigmatic version of Robert, to where he's making better swing decisions. He's running really well. Why isn't he doing anything? And you try to acquire him and you're not sure if he's going to produce at all. I think that's a much harder sell and a much bigger risk for a team taking him on versus if he's just somebody who mashes lefties. That's cool. You can use that. Like you can, yeah, if you have the right mix in your outfield, you can certainly add that and feel good about it. And anything else he does against righties, so much the better. So that's, I think, as long as he keeps hitting lefties, he has a role. But I think in order for him to really get something transformative for the White Sox farm system, even if it's just one player, I think he's going to have to hit righties better, show more impact contact against righties for him to move the needle in that regard.
Yeah, I thought Robert's trade stock went up after this weekend because, to your point, Jim, with that great defensive catch, I think any team that acquires Robert is not expecting a middle-of-the-order type of bat. Like, they're expecting, can you bat seventh? Can you bat eighth in our what could be already considered a stacked lineup? Mm-hmm. And if that's your expectations for Robert, I think any team that acquires Robert would be happy because the other things that he can provide, I mean, he's been playing really good defenses of late, and he's still healthy. He's still running. So I think that there are key attributes that could help a team lengthen their lineup by acquiring Robert. You mentioned the money issue, that contract buyout amount, which is $2 million. Should Chris Getz just expect to be having to eat that cost and get that approval from Jerry Reinsdorf no matter what?
Yeah, I think it's more about the amount left on his current year salary as well. I think that'll be the money we're talking about versus, yeah, the couple million for a buyout, that's nothing. It's more, do you want to try to cover half of the cost of his salary? Do you want to throw in, do you want to buy a prospect, essentially, the way the Mets did? I think that's kind of the idea here.
I wonder what the White Sox will do. Like, from my perspective, it's a no-brainer. Like, I'd eat up half of the money remaining to get the best possible prospect in return.
Yeah, it's more a matter of like, you know,
gauge what Jerry would want to do.
Yeah, it's if you're going to try to sell it, I would say, you know, he's going to be off the books next year. That's $20 million that is reduced from the payroll. In an ideal situation, we would be picking up the buyout anyway and then trading him after the winter because he hasn't played himself into it. We can't afford that risk. So give me at least some money to make this more exciting for White Sox fans, more palatable versus just another depressing transaction at the end of July that nobody feels good about and makes no difference. Will it work? Probably not. Or at least, you know, it might be a more inconsequential amount the White Sox are willing to pitch in like they did for Eloy Jimenez. But I would hope that they would take a page from that Mets playbook and just say, for this year, for this player, given, hey, they're on Comcast, that's going to mean something in terms of revenue projection. Throw in $5 million or something like that just to try to increase the return.
All right. Well, we'll see what the White Sox actually do. We'll see how the trade assets for the White Sox perform in the next series, because it is a quick turnaround for the White Sox. But let us know in the comment section on SoxMachine.com and also in social media what you guys think of the trade stock. Did it go up, no change, or down for Adrian Hauser, Mike Tauchman, and Luis Robert after the big weekend in Pittsburgh? While it's been a lot of fun to talk about how much fun we had in Pittsburgh and watching the White Sox play in Pittsburgh, unfortunately, life goes on. And the Chicago White Sox will be heading to Tampa, Florida to take on the Rays. The Rays are 52-48 this year, four games above 500. But in the very competitive American League East, that means they're currently fourth place in the division. They're 6.5 games back of first place of the Toronto Blue Jays, but the Rays are still in the playoff hunt. They're just a game and a half back of the sixth seed. They lost their last game, but the Rays have been scuffling a little bit. In their last 10, they are 3-7. At home this year, the Rays are 30-26. When you take a look at the Rays offense, they're averaging 4.67 runs per game. Does not matter if that's on the road or at home. They are averaging the same amount of runs. They do hit better at home. They have a team OPS of 755. That's good for ninth in Major League Baseball for teams hitting at home. On the pitching front, the home ERA for the staff for the Rays is 3.69. That's middle of the pack in Major League Baseball. That is 15th in baseball. Your probable pitchers for this series, Monday night, 6:35 p.m. Central Time start. Sean Burke will get the ball against Shane Bass. Bass this year has a 4.17 ERA. He's 8-5 win-loss wise. On Tuesday night, 6:35 p.m. Central Time start. This was supposed to be Shane Smith, but Smith is now on the injured list due to a knee injury. Drew Rasmussen, who made the All-Star team, will get the ball for the Rays. He's got a 2.86 ERA this season. And then on Wednesday, it is a 6:35 p.m. Central Time start. Jonathan Cannon, who threw the ball well against the Pirates in his last outing, will get the ball. Taj Bradley will get the start for the Rays with his 4.35 ERA. So after getting a chance to face some lefties, the White Sox will be facing three right-handed starters from the Tampa Bay Rays over the weekend. But that Tuesday start, Jim, it was supposed to be Shane Smith, but we are hearing it could be the return of the dart, Davis Martin, to take that spot. I'm hoping that Shane Smith is not out for a lengthy time. Knee injuries can be pretty tricky. But I'm curious to see what Davis Martin can bring to the White Sox. Has he been making any rehab outings in Charlotte?
Yeah, he's made a couple. And supposedly feels good. The lines aren't that impressive, but when it comes to Charlotte pitching, there are a lot of unimpressive lines just in that environment. So he's throwing well, supposedly feeling great. With Smith, they're looking to limit his workload. He's already met the active days threshold for being able to keep a Rule 5 pick next year with no restrictions in terms of optioning. Not that I think they would be looking at optioning Smith the way he's been throwing, but they don't have to worry about returning him is the bigger point. So they can have the scheduled rest. They can look for like the most, or I guess the slightest reason to rest him. And I think like the ankle issue, you know, who knows if it's real. I guess it was taped up. Perhaps he rolled it. Yeah, I think on Pittsburgh sidewalks, I rolled my ankles three times walking around. So perhaps it's a case where he did the same and trainer saw it and just like, quick, wrap him up before we need Davis Martin back. We're going to have him back. So let's use this to get him on the injury list, break out the crutches and the gurney and let's take him out of here. That's kind of my read on it, but yeah, it should be Martin. One note about the, going from PNC to, Steinbrenner Field, you mentioned the righties, going from two soft tossing lefties or softish tossing lefties in the case of, Falter to, righties when they made the All-Star game. That's a big difference. Going from PNC Park to Steinbrenner Field, twice as many homers hit at Steinbrenner Field. So it's going to be tougher, I think, to hit the ball with authority. But if they have the same kind of contact, you should see more balls go out there. So I guess that's maybe the motivation there to lift and pull right-handed pitching if they can.
Yeah, this is going to be a tricky series for Sean Burke and Jonathan Cannon just to keep the ball in the ballpark, even for Davis Martin as well. He is the starter on Tuesday. Junior Caminero, who made the All-Star team, the very gifted, very young hitter, has 16 home runs this year at home. In games at Steinbrenner Field this year, in 54 games, Junior Caminero has a 978 OPS. So that's a hitter to circle. Yandy Diaz has 12 homers at home this year. He's got an 849 OPS. Jonathan Aranda, who also made the All-Star team, he's batting 341 at home this year. So some Rays hitters are really enjoying hitting at Steinbrenner Field. So that was one of the things that was overlooked this weekend is, yeah, Adrian Hauser didn't have a spectacular start, but Aaron Civale pitched well on Sunday, and Jonathan Cannon pitched really well on Friday. I thought the White Sox could have pushed Jonathan Cannon into the eighth inning to keep him going. He was throwing so well against Pittsburgh. Sean Burke, Jonathan Cannon, Davis Martin, they're going to have a tough test here, I think, against the Rays offense. Like, the White Sox offense hopefully can continue to capitalize on fastballs, because I think these are going to be high-scoring games, Jim.
Yeah, and it's going to be a good just test of this new plate approach the White Sox have, or at least maybe not new plate approach, but just the emphasis they placed on just don't get bullied by fastballs. And if they can turn around, then it's a case of you got good breaking stuff in this this series of pitchers as well. But at least make them change the game plan a little bit. Make them think, I think, is the challenge that I want to see the White Sox accomplish in these three games. I'm not counting on, 27 runs again? Positive 20 games. Run differential over three games. But couple homers would be nice. And, seeing the same plate approach against more talented pitching and seeing the same kind of rewards, at least until they flip the script on them. And then, perhaps it's back to the drawing board.
It's a tough 9-game stretch for the White Sox. I mean, they're 3-0 post All-Star break, but it's 3 on the road against the Rays, and they come home after a Thursday day off, a weekend series against the Chicago Cubs. Wrigley Field is going to be absolutely packed for those three games. And then it's followed up by a 3-game series against the Philadelphia Phillies. So the White Sox here, a tough 9-game stretch coming up. Keep the vibes, though, high, because they should be for the White Sox, playing with some confidence heading to Tampa from Pittsburgh. But make no mistake about it, it is a tough 9-game stretch for the White Sox. Hopefully they do play up to the competition. We'll be recapping that Rays series when we record a new podcast. That will be on Thursday night, so we'll have that ready to go for you guys on Friday morning as we get ready, not just to recap what happens to the White Sox and Rays, but also preview the White Sox and Cubs series as we inch closer to the trade deadline. The Chicago Cubs should be a pretty active team, maybe one of the most active teams in Major League Baseball. But speaking of Major League Baseball, as we end every episode on the Monday show, we take a look around Major League Baseball. And Jim, the thing that's catching my attention is that the Chicago Cubs are playing great baseball. They're 59-40. That's the second best record in baseball. They're 6-4 in their last 10. And Cubs fans should be ecstatic about it. Being 19 games above 500, approaching the 100 game mark, you're in great position of making the playoffs. You should be in great position winning the division. However, here come the Milwaukee Brewers. It's like routine. The Brewers have won 10 straight games. The Milwaukee Brewers have owned the Los Angeles Dodgers this year, and they have caught the Cubs in the standings. They are now tied with the Chicago Cubs for first place in the National League Central. The Cubs haven't done anything wrong. They just continue playing their game, but that's just how hot the Brewers have been. And a big catalyst offensively for the Brewers is Andrew Vaughn. In 8 games of the Brewers, Andrew Vaughn has an OPS over 1,200. I'm just dumbstruck because where has this been? What Vaughn is doing for the Brewers, Jim, where has this been with the White Sox. He's got two home runs. He's got 12 RBIs in 8 games with the Brewers. Vaughn had 19 RBIs in 48 games with the White Sox this season. In 48 games with the White Sox this season, Vaughn had 7 walks. He's already got 6 with the Brewers. Like, what did Milwaukee do? What happened in Nashville? How come the Brewers are getting the version of Andrew Vaughn that we all envisioned the White Sox would get after they used the 3rd overall pick on him? And we spent, I don't know how many episodes, how many thousands of minutes of our lives debating in what kind of hitter Andrew Vaughn is. And now in a very small sample size, he has greatly helped the Milwaukee Brewers to catch the Chicago Cubs and have one of the best records in Major League Baseball.
I mean, not a terrible outcome. I think if you're looking at Andrew Vaughn in terms of how could an Andrew Vaughn turnaround be the least frustrating kind, I would say doing it for the Brewers against the Cubs might be the most palatable way to have it happen. Like if he were doing it for the Cubs or for the Dodgers or for the Red Sox or some other team where their fate does not directly impact White Sox fans' moods by, you know, perhaps having an annoying Cubs fan friend or somebody in the household when the Brewers win and Andrew Vaughn is directly responsible, that's kind of fun. So I would say in that regard, enjoy it, because if you were doing it for a less consequential team, then you would have no benefit whatsoever, aside from seeing like he's made a fix that the White Sox couldn't implement. And you have to wonder what they're doing here. I'm looking at like the Statcast data, and it doesn't look like, you know, if this is a small sample size, of course, but it does look like he's shortened his swing a little bit. It does look like he's getting the attack angle is up, the ideal attack angle is up, the swing length is shorter, especially against fastballs. So he just might be on time more and rediscovered it in a way that he didn't before. Also a case of let's see if he's made a change that the league can adjust to, and just all it takes is one tweak in the scouting report and all of a sudden he is, he's back to struggling, hitting the ball on the ground. But yeah, it does seem like he's made some kind of change. And, we knew his timing was off. We knew, that the White Sox sent him down to Charlotte because they thought he was out of sync. So perhaps it's a case of he's made the change that they implemented and he might have done this with the White Sox, or it might be a case of new organization. Perhaps they had some say in it because the Brewers are pretty good about getting production from unexpected corners. And who knows? Like, it could be a case of him getting a positive change of scenery, getting competitive games, at bats that matter. When you play so many games 3 years in a row where your plate appearances, they matter individually, they matter, they matter to winning the team. But in terms of like the shape of a season, there's no consequence to a homer with the White Sox when they are going to lose 100 games, 3 years in a row. So perhaps just the being in a new uniform and being called up, and these games matter. Every single game matters right now, both for the trade deadline and then afterwards as well, when you get actually in the pennant race territory. Perhaps that's a case where it's just, there's a little bit of a, not that he wasn't trying, but just perhaps there's some realization of what you've missed when you've been playing for a team that's been that bad for that long.
If this same type of outcome happens when Luis Robert gets traded to another team, I just find that to be a very difficult conversation, because I was on WGN on TV a few days ago and Jared Payton on live TV asked me what's going on with Luis Robert. I don't know. Like, I don't know why it's clicking for Robert. I don't know why he's been so inconsistent with the White Sox. But I use the example, if you trade Robert to San Diego and he's with Manny Machado and Fernando Tatis Jr., and he absolutely crushes and he catches on fire for the final 2 months of the season and helps the Padres make the playoffs, you're going to get a lot of White Sox fans wondering, why didn't you do that with us? And why is Andrew Vaughn hitting at a level that he never hit when he was with the White Sox? Why does this continue to happen where guys are leaving the White Sox and finding success? And I don't know how the White Sox front office or even like Chris Getz even begins to answer that question, but it is going to be a question that's continued to ask Jim. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I wonder, will this happen for Luis Robert? Because, man, Andrew Vaughn, you have everyone in Milwaukee looking at Chicago right now wondering, why did you give up on this guy? We have mountains of data on why the White Sox gave up on him. Yeah, you're getting a version we never saw. So congratulations, Brewers. Enjoy it while it lasts.
At least Aaron Civale has looked better the last two times out. So
there's that.
He's serving the purpose that the White Sox needed. But yeah, I think you probably have two prongs of a defense for the White Sox. One would be perhaps a culture thing of just, yeah, they weren't trying, they were mailing it in. Yeah, maybe not a case of mailing it in, but just, we just got in this rut for so long. This is, yeah, the Brewers or whatever team gets something out of Robert. You know, those are the returns we want to see. We need to get better so that everybody's motivated to produce and know that their performances matter. That doesn't bode well necessarily. I think you get in this, you get back into the culture arguments and you get back into, you know, is everybody pulling in the right direction? I think in this case, there's no evidence to say that they aren't. You're not seeing any issues with the Will Venable administration that were so prevalent in the Pedro Grifol years, or year and a half, I should say, or even like the Tony La Russa, like autopilot years when, you know, especially when he was not healthy and the team was kind of running itself. In this case, I think you just have, you probably look at, we have Ryan Fuller, sure, but we also carried over Marcus Thames. What else do we need to do to try to make changes happen faster? But yeah, we'll see with Robert. We'll see also see with Vaughn, because Gavin Sheets came out hot. He's been gradually cooling off to where he's doing okay for the Padres, but kind of the okay we saw four stretches with the White Sox, no longer a, you know, great first base DH option, smoking right-handed pitching, just more of an average bat the last couple months. And if Vaughn, you know, if they realize like, oh, he's back to hitting the fastball again, we just need to you know, use breaking balls to expand his zone and get him back into his ruts. Could be the same case with Vaughn. So more of a sample size needs to be seen. But for the time being, he's picking a good time to maximize his production and at least the White Sox fans get something out of it.
So for you, Jim, what's catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
Tigers finally, you know, hit a little bit of a rough patch. They got out of it. Scooble pitched them out of it, but lost six in a row. And this is the kind of game, reminds me a little bit of the White Sox in 2021, building up such a big lead that do they get complacent at the deadline? Do they kind of lose the ability to know how weak they are in certain respects because they haven't been challenged? So, you know, this kind of losing streak that they're still at the best record in the American League, but now it's closer to everybody else. They're no longer running away with it. Curious to see whether that changes anything. Still have an 11 game lead on the Guardians, but the Guardians, you know, they got hot a little bit too. It's just been very uneven forms of slightly below 500 for the rest of the division. So, you know, that's more or less kind of what I'm expecting for the rest of the year. Also the Mariners, some life back in them, putting a scare into the Astros. Right now it looked like, or at least before this week, it looked like the East was going to be the only pennant race over the course of the last 2 months, with the Astros just kind of just expanding their lead gradually, a game a week or something like that, until you realize like, oh, there's no hope here for the Mariners or the Rangers. But the Mariners, some life in them. Cal Raleigh still awesome, and you want to see more pennant races. I think when you have so many wild card spots available, three wild card spots, if the division races don't matter, then I think it just, you know, it feeds my fears of expanding the postseason to begin with. Is if you don't have to try for first place, you know, why even build good teams or great teams if a good one will suffice? So want to see more pennant races, especially the Brewers closing the gap the way they did, starting to happen.
I think we're to get them in the American League East, the National League East, the Central. I think each division in the National League, we can end up having a race. The Dodgers had a pretty healthy lead, but that shrunk down to 3.5 games with their recent skid. The Padres are 3.5 games back of the Dodgers right now. I don't know if the Padres, as is strong enough to challenge the Dodgers, but they're good enough to make sure the Dodgers can't run away with the division. I think we're just going to see chaos, though, in the American League East, the National League East, between the Phillies and Mets. That's going to be a great battle all the way to the final game of the season. And we'll see the Milwaukee Brewers can keep turning the heat on the Chicago Cubs. And you got Cincinnati lurking there in third place right now, trying to get themselves back into the wild card. They're 2.5 games back of the Padres for the final wild card spot. So, and this will all influence in how teams and how active they are before the trade deadline. Let's see if one of those teams currently outside the playoff picture gets bold and makes a big deal before the deadline.
One question I have when it comes to the Robert market is, like, do you think the Dodgers could be involved?
Always.
Yeah. It's like not the traditional form, but I was thinking about it, looking at the last trade deadline when they acquired Kevin Kiermaier, and just like, we want the defense. We need the real center fielder in the mix. We want that standout tool just to, you know, make sure we're not overstretching, you know, our utility infielders too much in center field. And they went out and did it. And just curious, the Robert, could they do the same thing? Maybe more of a, is even a blocking move. Like, we can pay his salary. We can, you know, we have some ways to get him better. If he doesn't, he'll just be a highly paid fourth outfielder for us, because left field is kind of a mess. And, you know, we can move one of our center fielders over to left field when Robert's playing there. I think they could be more of a threat in the Robert market than perhaps I gave him credit for, especially with the way the Brewers kind of, they wrestle him down to the ground over the weekend. It might be a case where they feel like they need a high upside deadline acquisition versus just patching holes.
Well, Michael Conforto's been bad for the Dodgers this year. I mean, that was a lot of money that they spent to have Conforto to be outfield depth. I'd rather have Robert than Conforto.
Yeah. And so they're kind of complementary too, like lefty righty. So if you're, so I mean, like, if you think Robert's a platoon bet, you have somebody to platoon him with.
I don't think they would, though. I think they'd be just fine having Robert bat ninth and play center field and move Andy Páez to a corner.
Yep. But, you know, just theoretically, you know, Conforto hasn't been great against righties, but they would have a way to shield Robert if they felt like they needed to.
Yeah. Oh, now that you mentioned the Dodgers, it's like, all right, here, how are the Dodgers going to get Adrian Hauser and Luis Robert to make the same type of trade they did last year? They can point to, hey, Miguel Vargas is hitting for you guys. That's working. Let's do that again.
Vargas
is
kind of
for everybody.
He's been hot and cold. But yeah, I think you, given the way that they've had to move guys around and play guys out of position, I think Robert, that Kevin Kiermaier's only got me thinking about that.
Got it. No, that's a good point. It's a good question, Jim. We'll see if the Dodgers do make that type of move. If there's more activity and more smoke to the trade fire for the White Sox players before the deadline. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you to Ankin Law for sponsoring this show. And thank you to everyone that visited us out in Pittsburgh. Again, let's get that schedule for 2026 sooner than later, despite what Jim wants. I need it for planning. But again, if you had FOMO, if you missed out, can't wait to see you guys next year. There'll be a couple opportunities to meet up once again. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. If you just discovered the show, you can subscribe to the show however you listen to podcasts through Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch the podcast at our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sox Machine. We also post videos up there. If you missed out on seeing me on WGN, I did post that segment on our YouTube channel, so you can check it out, youtube.com/Sox Machine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine, including Instagram, as we're trying to build up our audience over there. We're also in Blue Sky. You can follow us at SoxMachine.com. You can follow James at jrfegan.SoxMachine.com. And you can follow me at josh.SoxMachine.com. Sox.com. If you enjoy our coverage and you want full access to everything we do about the Chicago White Sox, Jim Margulis has a sale right now for you to sign up and become a Sox Machine subscriber. So, Jim, break it down. How can they take advantage of this opportunity?
If you want to try out our coverage, we introduce it for the start of the second half. We'll expand it for a few more days since this is our first podcast of the second half. We didn't have the midweek show because everybody's traveling to Pittsburgh. But if you've been wanting to sample our coverage, if you see the White Sox sweeping the Pirates at PNC Park and thought, that was really watchable, perhaps I'll get more into this. We have a sale right now for our 5 WAR subscriber tier, $1 for the first month. Just throw a buck our way, get access to all of our coverage for the next month, and then subscribe. Beyond that is the idea for us, but that's our way of saying, hey, check it out.
And the subscribers go a long way, not only to help support James and what he does doing the daily coverage, Jim rocking it on the columns, the minor league, and every single day updating and keeping the lights on at SoxMachine.com. But it also helps out in our community events, like the meetups as well. So if you are not a subscriber and you met us up in Pittsburgh and you're like, you know what? I'm going to help support you guys. I'm going to subscribe to Sox Machine. What better time than now to sign up for just $1 to become a Sox Machine subscriber, and you'll get all the activity of the upcoming draft signing bonuses and the MLB trade deadline activity as it trickles through.
And also, Charlotte Knights are in Nashville all week, so I will be down at First Horizon Ballpark talking to Sergio Santos. Noah Schultz is on the IL, so probably won't see him start, but I will see another Noah S. apparently make a start for the Charlotte Knights. Syndergaard is on the roster. Very curious to see what he looks like, reminiscent of when Johnny Cueto made his debut in White Sox uniform organization with the Charlotte Knights at Nashville. So always fun to have a guy show up and I have no idea what you're throwing. Good luck. So let's see what that's all about. But yeah, I'll be talking to coaches, players, trying to figure out what exactly they have at the next rung down. So that'll be all for our subscribers as well.
Again, you can sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.